Well, this week, the precious metals flew to a new four-month record high. Silver briefly crossed $25, while gold touched $1,434 an ounce. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. I'm your host, Chris Walczek, and this August 23rd Encore Show, an all-star cast joins me with archived interviews, including commodities king Jim Rogers, the Dean of Doom, Harry S. Dent Jr., Wall Street whiz kid Peter Grandich, and Trends Dr. Gerald Celente. Plus, Robert Ian wraps up the show with an all-new editorial. So next week, we'll have all-new interviews as I open up the phone line and mailbag with all of your questions and comments. So we want you to stay with us here at GoldSeek.com Radio. Well, my next guest says that democracy as we know it may very well have met its demise, that the moneyed elite now rule the global economy. Gerald Celente, director of the Trends Research Institute, his team produces the Trends Journal, with hard-hitting, in-depth analysis of the economic, social, political, and cultural trends. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
You know, in your latest journal, you argue that democracy could come to an abrupt halt. Recently, the Fed chairman noted that the Fed can't get interest rates up very much because the economy would tank. There seems to be no exit plan in place from the Fed's $1 trillion annual buying spree of toxic securities. What does this mean, do you think, for the economy?
Well, it's very clear that the economy is going nowhere if they start tapering, as they call it, or if interest rates go up. The only thing that's kept the economy going that everybody knows is the so-called stimulus, which is really white shoe boy language for printing money out of thin air. Digital money not worth the paper it's not printed on. Despite the trillions of dollars that the Federal Reserve has printed and other central banks to boost the global economies, there's no recovery. It's a cover-up.
There's plenty of talk in the mainline media about green shoots, but unfortunately, the numbers just don't show that. We're watching, you know, the housing market, at least as far as new housing starts are concerned, rolling over. This tends to be a leading indicator. Plus, you know, unemployment stubbornly above even the Fed's target rate, been over 7.5, 7.6% for going on six consecutive years.
Well, let me just stop at that. It's really not. It's called a depression. This is what's happened before. You hear President Obama out on the campaign trail, for example. You know, his new dog and pony show is that how he's going to revive the economy, and he keeps throwing out these numbers of how many jobs that have been created under his administration. What they don't talk about is that they're 2 million short already, when you add in the people that have joined into the workforce since the Great Recession began. And the jobs that have been created, the other thing that he's not talking about is that they're mostly jobs that do not provide a living wage. The jobs that were lost during the Great Recession since it began, three-fifths of them were middle-income paying jobs. So again, there is no recovery. It's a cover-up. Look, once interest rates go up, the housing market goes down, this fake recovery stops. There is no exit strategy in ways of fixing the economy, Chris, just like there's never been an exit strategy to win the wars. There was no exit strategy for Vietnam, for Iraq, and for Afghanistan. Everything that the federal government does, from money to the military, and yet people keep voting them in and giving them their applauds of confidence.
And it's a chapter torn right from George Orwell's 1984. You talk about this perpetual warfare. Well, George Orwell wrote about this, and we're seeing so much of this activity in our country from now local municipalities flying drones all over this country, very heavily armored vehicles that are owned and operated by the DHS. Why don't you tell folks more?
Well, exactly. And by the way, this is going to be a big part of the next Trends Journal, too, and that you know, if you're forecasting trends, you'd be very concerned to know that martial law, a state of siege, is now going to become the routine for any time that there is a national crisis. For example, when you look what happened up in Boston back in April, yeah, they called a state of siege. They closed down over 100 square miles. Now, that was for one 19-year-old kid that they couldn't find. I mean, you know, check it out, man. You know, look at America's number one enemies. This 19-year-old kid, that guy Bradley Manning, now there's another guy you got to watch out for, and it's Edward Snowden, you know. They're kids. And this is what America is wasting its money on. But I want to make this point about that. They call the state of siege in Boston and close down 100 square miles, put businesses out of business for a day, schools and universities closed down, people were prohibited from leaving their homes.
Without warrants.
Without warrants, and making them come out with their hands up. I mean, what is this? Don't people see what's going on? So why are they doing this? I think, Chris, I agree with you 100%. And again, when you go back to our top trends for 2013, the top one was war. And that's what we're looking at. Class war, civil war, regional war, world war. And it's all adding up. And you pick a country, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Egypt, Romania, Russia, Bulgaria, Yemen, Sudan, Bahrain, Libya, Syria. You go down the list, up and down, India, China. Oh, you're talking about a slowdown? Now all the news is out there about the slowdown in China. And here's the deal. China consumes 40% of the natural resource metals. If China doesn't make stuff, the countries that are exporting natural resources to China, they're not exporting. If the Americans and the Europeans stop buying or slow down their buying, China's not making. There's real concern that China needs to have a GDP growth of at least 7% a year just to keep this Ponzi scheme afloat. And we were talking about the United States Central Bank pumping in all this cheap dough. China went overboard back in 2009 as well. You know, they dumped in trillions of yuan. So this whole thing is collapsing around the globe. There's no way of stopping the money printing. And when China said along, they said about the same time when Bernanke came out and talked about tapering, you look what happened to the global equity markets when all that happened, when China said that they weren't going to bail out their banks and Bernanke said that they were going to put tapering on the table. You saw the equity markets crashing. And then right away they all turned around and said, no, we're going to keep the money flow. And then it turned it around. So there's no way out, and that's why I'm still a believer in gold. And what happened to gold in the last couple of days is very important. You know, it's closing strongly above 1,300. And that's not all bad, because to me, and I've said this before on your show, our show, on Trends in the News that we have on every night, Monday through Friday, and on others, that when gold hit 1,200, around there, I said the downside risk at best is another $100 to $150. Now, you consider that. That's not a big downside risk because the upside potential is far greater. The upside potential, I've said it, I stick by it, and I believe it, is 2,000 plus. I'm in gold for the golden years. This isn't an everyday trade. Things are not getting better. The geopolitical atmosphere is heating up, and the global economies are cooling down. To me, those are the reasons, some of them, to stay with gold.
I mean, I think investors really need to do their due diligence and ask themselves, do I really feel confident putting my hard-earned wealth and capital into a bond market, which has arguably been in a bull market for decades and looks a bit tired here, is starting to roll over. Interest rates really can't go much lower, but there sure is room on the upside. Of course, we know the bond market negatively correlated with rates. That, in the macro picture, does not seem to bode well for that market. We should see billions, if not trillions, of dollars rolling out of bonds and into the commodities. And, of course, that can only benefit gold and silver. And then you can look at the equities market and ask a similar question. Well, we're in a bullish trend, but how much of that is behind us and just how much reward is here given the risk? As you pointed out, the scary part of the selling is mostly behind us and the risk to reward for precious metals certainly looking good.
You know, I bought my first buy of gold in 1978 at $187.50 an ounce. I also bought at the highest day in January, I think it was January 20th, 1980, and the intraday high was $875, and then it closed at $850, and then went down to crash for years after that. So I remember it well. It was a very different time. Back then, there was no China. Russia, poof, it was the Soviet Union, and everything east of Berlin was locked behind the Iron Curtain. The point being is that the markets were very thinly traded. Gold and silver. Silver was controlled by the Hunt brothers in the United States. It's a very different world. There was no India that was trading and buying gold. And what's very different this time as well is back then, and again, I was there. I know. I lost a ton of money, and I was a young guy. It hit me hard. And, you know, I wasn't used to it. I didn't know what I was doing. I was like a young guy. I was just making all this money, and all of a sudden, it collapsed. So I remember it very well. What's very different now than back then, and I challenge anyone, to prove me wrong, is back then when the price of gold went down, people weren't rushing to buy for physical possession. That's very different, and that's what's going on now. The demand for physical possession, particularly among Asians, is so strong now, as you well know, that the premium on physical has gone way up. And there are also, every now and then we're hearing it, shortages. The other issue in this as well is that back then people overall weren't buying as much for possession. It was mostly the paper markets. So the paper markets and the hard asset markets are two very different things.
Take a look at the premiums you alluded to, and of course this is the difference between the price in London compared with Shanghai and Hong Kong. We've seen the typical premium hovering around $5 there recently, premiums as high as $30, spiking to north of $100. This is an exponential increase, and of course what that implies to many of our market watchers, there is insatiable demand, particularly for bullion, the smart money, if you will. They want to get their hands on as much bullion as possible as this paper shellacking comes to pass. But, you know, I'd also like to move back to unemployment for a moment. A couple of troubling statistics here domestically. Nearly half of U.S. is near or at the poverty level. This according to the U.S. Census Bureau's latest figures. This is not a pie-in-the-sky number pulled out of some blogosphere. This is, according to the Census Bureau, one of their latest numbers, half of the country, about 147 million people, are either at or near the poverty level, one paycheck away from moving into their cars.
Well, I mean, it's the future. It's been a takeover. The major multinationals have taken over. There is no opportunity. Here's the deal. Again, I'm old enough to remember. There used to be a thing called drugstores when I was a kid. You know, and every community had their own, and they had the local pharmacist owned it. Now what do you have? And they own all the other vertical elements of the business as well. And then you look at, man, there was no Macy's when I was a kid. There were two of them, one down in Harold Square, the other one up in Yonkers. Now they're everywhere. What did that do to all the clothing stores? And, of course, I'm only talking about Macy's, but just go around the country and listen to the names. You know, you know, Nordstrom's, you go down the list. Target, one after. There was no Walmarts. You know, there were five and tens. You know, you didn't buy big stuff. And then you, same thing, you keep going around. There was another thing, very quaint, you know, arcane thought. They used to have family farms. Oh, yeah. And the big there was no such thing as agribusiness. And one guy didn't control it, or one big company. And now you have a handful. I mean, you have one company that owns just about all the seeds now. And then you keep going down the list, Chris. go down to, I'm up here in Colonial Kingston, New York, an hour and a half north of New York City. Right down the street was O'Reilly Stationery Store. O'Reilly? Who? There's Staples and there's Office Depot. We don't need any entrepreneurs to be in business, not when the big hedge funds and private equity groups could control all the business. And then you get out of college owning $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $100,000 worth of debt that you're becoming an indentured servant to, and what could you do with it? I got an idea. You could get a job at ShopRite. You could get a job at Staples, at Walmart, at Home Goods. You could get a job stocking shelves, or you could work at the cashier. And if you're really good, you know, you'll get a maybe an advancement someday. And you can become, even if you're really great, a store manager. Hey, how about this one? Hardware stores. Isn't that a quaint thought? And what the other people, and the people don't realize, is that the more the consolidation, not only does it put the small entrepreneur out, now your product line really diminishes. When you had all those stationery stores, you had a lot more selection. And the same thing with hardware and down the line. Now your selections are also limited only to the big companies that are big enough to stock the big guys.
Another topic you touch on in the latest journal, and you alluded to this just a moment ago, debt. For instance, about half of U.S. households are carrying credit card balances month to month, but few realize that just an average balance over many years can rack up, now hold on to your hats for this one, millions of dollars by retirement age. Half of households spend more than they earn and leave this world than less than they had at birth.
Well, it's the decline of the United States for all the reasons that we're talking about. It's criminal. It's a criminal activity to me to get some young kid, 17, 18, 19 years old, they want to go to college, and they had their parents sign off on the debt. How about that? That we mentioned it, but to add on to what you're saying is that now college debt is over $1 trillion. It's more than credit card debt, and the parents are signing off of this. So the kids can't pay. Now the parents are being forced to pay. If they can't pay, they lose what they have, including their homes. And if the parents, they hoodwinked their grandparents into doing it, and now they're on the hook. This is a criminal operation. It's the money changers. It's absolutely no different than when Jesus Christ was around driving the money changers out of the temple. And it's no different than years later, you know, thousands of years later, when James Madison also warned us in the same language about the money changers. The money changers have taken over. And it's about time somebody drives them out of the temple. But the temple now is, it's Frankfurt. It's the city of London. It's Wall Street and Washington. Those are the temples. It's a takeover.
Boston University economist Lawrence Kotlikoff has calculated that the U.S. government is facing unfunded liabilities of $222 trillion. But, of course, I'm sure he's including Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. I'd like your thoughts as to whether or not this is going to be tenable and just how you think the government will try to work its way out of this mess. Will they just fire up the printing press?
All you have to do is look at Detroit. Detroit is a metaphor for what's going on in the United States in a number of ways. Number one, it's gone from Motown to No Town, and it's not the fault of just exporting our jobs overseas. It's also the fault of GM, Chrysler, and Ford, and the major manufacturers. And I've dealt with these companies before as a trend forecaster. You couldn't tell them anything. They knew nothing and had an attitude that the sun rose and set in their little minds. So they got what they deserved. And it's caused to me, you know, they're still not the right vehicles. You know, they look like something out of a video game that has nothing to do with the operation of a car and makes it more expensive to fix. Having said that, the other way the cities have been destroyed in the country is with all of this urban renewal. They cut up Detroit, New Haven, you name the country, all into little tiny pieces by running roads through them. So they kill the core of the country. They export the jobs, and America's been behind the scene so many different ways in innovation, in turning it into, in rather than survival, and that's all they ever think about. So to go back to your question, how do you get out of this? And again, using Detroit as the example, they can't pay their pensions. Well, by the way, and benefits to their employees, the banks are getting 75 cents on the dollar. That shows you how rigged the game is. Now, how's the United States going to get out of this and all the other cities, communities, and states that are also over-leveraged in pensions and benefits? They're not. Are they going to yank up the printing presses? That's your other question. I don't believe so. I think they'll devalue the dollar. And that's the way they'll get around it. One way or another, it's going to be whether they print more money or call for an official devaluation. It's the same thing. The result is that what you own in terms of currency is going to be a lot worth a lot less than what you thought it was as they continue to devalue it, which again goes back to that's why I like gold. I am not a gold buyer because of my fear of hyperinflation. I buy gold because of the obvious devaluation that's in front of our eyes every day with $85 billion a month of buying mortgage-backed securities and bonds and all of the stimulus that's gone into the economy via low interest rates and allowing banks to borrow for essentially nothing to keep the economy going, and that's what's boosting the stock market and mostly corporate profits.
You also say the United States Constitution is under assault, that this trend is emerging, though, all over the globe, and that economic malaise is leading to widespread poverty, increased violence, and we're certainly seeing that accelerate. Nearly 50 million Americans now require food stamps to put food on the dinner table. Over a million American school kids are homeless, living with their parents either in cars or in tent villages. I'd like your thoughts on the assault on the American Constitution.
Well, again, it's been assaulted in so many different ways. But let's talk about Trayvon Martin or what else could we do? Oh, well, how about the princes, the new prince? You know, they named him George. I thought they named him Trayvon, you know. I mean, the major media broke away from all their regular programming to watch the prince and the duchess come out of the hospital holding their kid and all goo-gooing and gaga-ing over the spectacle. So why should we talk about anything important? You know, I mean, the whole thing is collapsing in front of us, and people don't want to recognize that it cannot be fixed. You're talking about a robbing of rights. Snowden now is out of the news. You just had a couple of days ago where the House tried to put amendments on that would restrict the National Security Agency from watching everything that we do, covering our every move that we make. It was defeated under intense pressure by the Obama administration. You're looking at, as I mentioned earlier, martial law declared in Boston following the Boston bombing. You just saw night maneuvers in Chicago with Black Hawk helicopters flying over the loop. You're looking now at the military waging urban maneuvers in major cities. And now also, even worse than that, and as part of it, they have just killed the Bill of Rights. They shredded it. And very interestingly, Chris, this issue about the military taking over civil duties, that was one of the reasons for the revolution. And people seem not to know that. Why should they know it? But that's what really happened. That was one of the things that they railed out against King George because, quote, he had affected to render the military independent of and superior to civil power. Well, that has now been abolished by the White House and the military. And you were talking before about, you know, all of these localities now having SWAT teams and having these armored vehicles and the militarization of the police force. So that's where it's going. It's in front of us. I'm not making any of this up. Matter of fact, even the Wall Street Journal did a major story on the rise of the warrior cop.
I guess it's a cliche now, but we've heard the expression, when people fear their government, there is tyranny, but when government fears the people, there's freedom. So here's a question. What do you fear more, terrorists or your government?
That's it, of course. You know, and again, you know, is John Adams wrong? Is liberty once lost, lost forever? Or can it be restored? It's up to the individual. When enough people stand up and speak out and say no, then it's going to change.
People are terrified. My theory, it's just a pet theory, maybe a working thesis, if you will. When inflation has robbed people of their disposable income to such an enormous level to where half the country is living from paycheck to paycheck, if not worse than that, because you could say the other half are virtually dependent on the government for sustenance. When you reach that critical mass, I'm convinced that folks are simply terrified of making any waves for fear of capsizing their boat.
You may be 100% correct, but what boat do they live? They're in a sinking boat anyway. And look what just happened in Bulgaria. This is something that, of course, you know, how about the, I wonder how the Duchess is doing, you know? I mean, come on, you know, nobody's talking about Bulgaria. They don't even know what Bulgaria is in this country. And what they had, the people have been out in the street protesting for 40 days. They had to call in the police because they barricaded the parliament and wouldn't let the ministers and MPs out. You know, they're demanding justice.
Because in order to protest for 40 days, you've got to have some stockpile. You've got to have a family farm or something to fall back on to provide you with sustenance for 4 days, let alone 40 days here, because we're all working ourselves to the bone just to try to pay all the bills that are pouring in.
And look at the people, my God. I mean, it's like they have to eat every 5 seconds. I mean, look at this country's, you know, it's the most obese nation in the world. You walk around, you say, Mike, what happened? Look at the young people. I mean, you know, when I was in school, you know, there were a couple of heavy kids, but it was mostly genetic, and they were big kids, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's emblematic of, I think, two big problems we're facing. Firstly, overly calorically filled foods and nutritionally deplete. And when you add those two things together, you have people eating essentially high-calorie foods, which do nothing to satisfy your appetite, and then throw in there all of these excitotoxins, which say, to the brain, i.e. like MSG and so many others, aspartame, which turns into formaldehyde, embalming fluid in your brain. Okay, I mean, you add all these factors in, and you just have half the country in dire straits. Are there any other topics you'd like to close this dialogue with today?
Well, on the one you're on, and that's the future, and it's a big trend, whole health healing, and that's where the money is, clean food. I coined that term, by the way, in 1993, and you may not know this. I have an honorary doctorate degree in complementary medicine for the work that I've done over the years in the field from the National University of Health Sciences. So I agree with 100% with what you just said about food, and that's the future. If you want an entrepreneurial business that's going to make money, make you feel good, and make people better, healthier, and more spiritually attuned to what's going on, because that's what it's going to take to make the change happen, that's the business for you. And I also want to let you know that we're redesigning the Trends Journal. It's going to be a whole new look, all new features, and it's going to show you history before it happens like nothing else on the planet, and it'll be out in a couple of weeks, so I urge everyone to subscribe, and of course, there's a money-back guarantee.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Salente, we want to thank you today for all of your insightful thoughts and comments. We want to wish you continued success.
Thanks for having me.
Well, with the precious metal sector showing some positive price action, who better to have back on the show than a veteran of Wall Street, Peter Grandich. For over a quarter of a century, he has published commentary on the mining and metals sector and is editor of the Grandich Letter. Any time on the golf course this summer?
Probably played the least amount of golf since I took up the game 13 years ago, partly weather and partly trying to calm myself down from what was happening in the gold market. So, no, I haven't spent that much time out there as much as I like to.
No, it's understandable. It's certainly been a difficult year after 12 very sunny years. You know, we've seen some positive price action. According to Jim Sinclair, there's been a big decline in the COMEX warehouse inventories, and he thinks this could force officials to change their physical delivery system. The COMEX will have to shift, apparently, to cash settlement rather than bullion, and that also includes some interesting machinations with the GLD shares, that's the gold ETF. According to one media source, COMEX inventories are quite depleted. In fact, the stockpile amounts to less than $10 billion. Any thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's all part of something that has come together in my eyes to the point where earlier today I wrote a report to my readers saying I was in the most bullish position ever on gold, and that says a lot for me. And what I really had a chance to do was to take a look back and really take a hard look at this and try to be objective. And what I concluded was it all started when the announcement first came from the Germans that, A, they couldn't get in to see their gold, and then finally when they were able to, they accepted just a 20% shipment back over a period of 7 years. And I stopped and I said, you know, that just doesn't make any sense. It's not realistic. It's not right. There's something very wrong there. That was followed, of course, by the dramatic and very unusual trading patterns of selling gold at the worst of times anyone that was a real seller would. Combine that with the fact that while the paper market was declining, there was such great demand for gold that it was still selling at $100 or higher than the paper price. Then we learned most recently that China and Asia in general have been enormous buyers of the gold. And then combine that with what you just mentioned, that these gold declines that are happening in vaults. And it, you know, the old saying, something is rotten in Denmark. Well, it may not be rotten in Denmark, but it's rotten at the COMEX or the CRIMEX, what I like to call it. So there's all of this has just made me think and try to get past the emotional wear and tear from the recent decline and to say that, wait a minute, there's something very wrong here, and if I'm right, then the reversal's going to happen, and it's going to happen in a big way, and that's what I concluded now and what I'm looking forward for.
You know, Jim Sinclair also goes on to note that gold will soon soar above $2,000 on its way to $3,500. Gold then could kick into overdrive and blast even 10 times higher. Jim Sinclair is arguably one of the top folks in the sector. He has been for many years. I'd like your thoughts on his forecasts and what you think about some of those lofty price targets.
Well, first of all, I go back with Jim for many years. I've appeared on different panels in different parts of the world with him. I have a high degree of respect for him. He certainly has put his money where his mouth is, and he's been adamant. He's never hedged or double-talked. You know, I can live with his $2,000. That certainly would be enough at this point, and I certainly would welcome $3,500. But I start to wonder what the world would be like and what the life we would be living if we had a 10 times higher price. I just would... It may not be worth it, even if we're all long gold, because we might not have any place to enjoy the riches of those gains. But I certainly believe the $2,000 to $3,500 is very realistic and not pipe dreaming, and have a lot of respect from the man that's saying it.
Investors are demanding gold delivery worldwide, particularly in Asia. Now, when compared to a stock like, let's say, Google or Apple, with a market cap with hundreds of billions of dollars, just one of those Dow components alone could buy up most of the COMEX inventory, in many cases several fold, many times over. Plus, J.P. Morgan and Brinks are reporting huge drops in their inventories. At what point will we see a huge shift in investor mentality where the funds just funnel from one extreme to another into the precious metals?
Well, I think there would have to be a smoking gun. Something would have to transpire that would certainly demonstrate that, you know, something has gone very, very wrong. I do think we get an indication of that, and that is that some of the most historically short people who have been adamant on the short side have let it be known that minimally they've at least covered their shorts. We've also seen a dramatic change in the commitment of traders, suggesting that those who used to heavily profit and mostly always be on the short side have at least removed a lot of those shorts and in some instances have actually gone long. So I think we have the starting of it, but it would probably take something of an actual realization, a failure of delivery of bullion or what have you, or even Jim's declaring that there would be a change in the delivery system. Then I think the sharks would smell and see the blood in the water, and they would come charging in. But I always try to remind everybody, we still live in a world of finance where 98% of the people's focus is on financial assets and their livelihood depends on it. So they're not about to let or be partake or help aid something like you point out rather than try to bury it, because they would be so much hurt in what they already have. So I think it would take something of very significance, but I do think we have the makings of at least that coming about in some way, because we're now seeing a great shift in the sentiment and actual trades by people who are historically always short the metals.
You know, even the New York Stock Exchange traders there are warming up to gold. Legendary floor trader Art Cashin, you may have heard, he's quite bullish on the yellow metal. He noted that for several months, physical gold, such as bracelets, coins, jewelry, small bars, have had insatiable demand, while paper gold has languished. So what is your take regarding the disconnect between the paper and the physical markets, please?
I think it goes back to what I discussed earlier, that there's really two different markets, and the paper market has been an artificial one. And because of what happened, and I believe that people like Agata have been right, that there isn't the large reserves availability of gold out there. A lot of it's been lent out. Again, I got to go back to what I said at the beginning. If you just stop and think, forget everything else, and say, if somebody has something of somebody else's and that person asks for it back, but it's going to take 7 years to deliver just 20% of it back, you'd have to think that party did something with what that person had and has to accumulate it again so they can give it back to them. And that's where I think the big strength of and being bullish is based on. And that's what I think led to a move to try to shake out large quantities of physical gold by attacking the paper market. But it backfired on them, and instead it created even more of a demand for gold itself and physical gold. And I think the other thing that's important as we speak, and yet you don't get to see markets like this, and there's an old saying in the commodities market, when they go into backwardation, which gold has been hovering around these last few days, you never, ever short them. And that's, of course, when the current price is even higher than some current future prices, which strongly suggest that there's a shortage of that particular commodity around. So I think all these things, not forgetting today that we're off a little, and I just think that's some profit-taking after touching the first key resistance around 1350 last night. I just think this is all setting up now for a very, very significant move, a move that I think will be as big, if not bigger, when it's all said and done than any other move that's been in gold. And I want to just make an asterisk with that, as anybody that knows me for almost 30 years, I don't think I've ever spoken like that about gold. So it's not something I've been saying year in and year out, and like a broken clock, I'll be right. But the bottom line is I now think that we are on the verge of perhaps one of the biggest moves ever in the gold market.
I'd really like to see the yellow metal cross over that 1350 and close there solidly for a few weeks. You know, Art Cashin also agrees with analysts who claim that the recent market plunge was an assault by the powers that be, the central banks, who fomented the decline in order to buy back the gold that they had leased at much lower prices. Do you give this line of thought any credibility? Do you see some logic here?
The parties at B were shocked when the Germans showed up. First, let's not forget, they wouldn't even allow them in to see their own gold, and they still didn't get that chance, and then were told that it was going to take 7 years to get them back 20%. There's no question that there was something very wrong with that, and that's what the hope was. This whole exercise, if you remember the days when gold was sold and the times it was, and it just didn't make any sense, all that type of stuff. And then what backfired was while the paper market went down, it eagerly brought in more buyers for gold, not those people that owned it rushed to sell it to nobody buying it. And so I just think all that makes sense. I think, you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I do think we can see a good part of it before the end of the year. But the first order of business is, like you said, we need not only to get above 1350, we actually have to get above 1400 to really end any technical arguments that gold can still go a lot lower. Once that's done, the big, big resistance will be in the 1550 area, because that's where gold broke down and had originally held many times. But once through that, there'll be no argument then about it, you know, going to new highs. But, you know, first things first, let's get above 1350 and then 1400 in the coming days and weeks, and then we can go from there.
You know, recently the Federal Reserve chairman backed away from plans to taper monetary stimulus activities. It appears that all that talk was a bluff. Do you expect QE and interest rate plans to continue? And if so, how will this impact the metals?
I think that's an important thing that you state, and I've written and spoken about it at length in recent weeks. First of all, it was more than one step. Bernanke backtracked it, but I actually believe one of them back in April was the tapering was directly aimed not at the stock market but at the gold market to aid the decline, because within hours and then within a few days, many of the Fed governors came out and, you know, tried to backtrack what he had said. So I have no doubt in my mind, I don't see how they can ever backtrack. And it's very simple, and you can't get any of the "don't worry, be happy" people on CNBC, TAL TV, or any to ever answer this question. But the question I always have that none of them could ever answer is, if the Fed has been buying 85 and they're going to back down to 65 or $45 billion in bonds a month, if they ever go to zero, who will replace them to buy in order to keep funding a country that continuously runs in a deficit? I mean, Americans have to understand that we simply as a country spend more each day than we take in. And the way we funnel that deficit is to keep borrowing. Well, if the Fed doesn't create the money out of thin air and buy those bonds, who's going to buy the bonds to keep the deficit going? So, you know, that's why bonds are just an atrocious bet long term. And I just don't see how the Federal Reserve could ever get to the point to walk totally away from this. And the only way it will ever do that is through the inevitable blow-off of this debt when it will either be, you know, renegotiated or heavily monetized, and a combination of all three will be the same. And only after a long period of time of severe downturns does that debt get to be worked off, then when people have confidence in paper again. So I just don't see a way out for the Fed. And quite frankly, I think the Fed chairman sees that and is very much looking forward to not being the Fed chairman anymore.
In one of his recent comments, he actually said that he believes that if they were to curtail their purchases, their, you know, buying up about $85 billion monthly of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries amounting to $1 trillion a year, if they were to curtail or stop those purchases, and I quote here, the economy would tank. In other words, I think if we could decipher some of this Fed speak, there is no exit plan here.
Right. That doesn't, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of great minds that work on Wall Street, and most people are sheep, so they follow what the journalists say. And so when they talk about tapering, they think somehow it can be done and magically you remove all of that and somehow everything stays the same and we're all hunky-dory. It doesn't work like that in the real world. And, you know, that's what we have to keep in mind when you're long gold and all the talk that somehow quantitative easing ends and it's very bearish for gold. It's not. It's what helped gold get where it is and will actually help gold go higher. Because here's what I think the scenario is. I think the U.S. economy really tails off this fall and winter. And then because they already started or put tapering on the table, they will have to go back into a more aggressive quantitative easing mode, and they will go from being viewed as being ahead of the curve to behind the curve of helping the economy, and that's where the real problems will hit, and that's when the real monies will flow into gold. So they've actually, while they hurt gold short-term because of their actions, they actually aided it down the road because of their flip-flopping.
You know, another important aspect to this gold bull market is the negative real interest rate story. The threat of lower Fed stimulus has clearly moved rates higher, at least off those ZIRP lows. And we're even seeing the Treasury inflation-protected securities declining for the first time in many, many years. Has the lower interest rate trend, has that reversed course, or is this simply turbulence?
Well, I don't think we'll see the lows that we had before. Again, part of that is because of the tremendous amount of Fed buy-in. I also just think that some people have concluded and started to realize that putting money in at 1% or 2% isn't very smart. So I think there's been a natural pickup, irregardless of how strong or weak the economy or inflation is, that bonds got way overdone on the long side, and there's going to be more of an evening out of that. So I can see interest rates going back up to 3 or 4% simply because it's being balancing off, not because the economy's roaring again. But let's not forget, you can still have a very weak economy and have interest rates go up dramatically, and that happened in Europe in the last few years as soon as people believed those sovereign countries were going to have trouble funding themselves. And that's what I believe will eventually happen in the States, probably not to at least next year. But when it comes, interest rates can go up dramatically, even without a strong economy.
Returning to gold for a moment, the U.S. Mint sold 21,000 ounces of American Gold Eagle so far this month. It's expected to eclipse last month's total figure. Outside the U.S., demand for precious metals also ratcheting up, as we mentioned. Gold demand in China continues to set records, offsetting sluggish demand in India. Hong Kong jewelers and banks are reportedly unable to meet demand. How significant is gold demand for higher prices in your perspective?
We saw that paper markets are really artificial and not really a signal of what's happening physically. Because think about it. When all those reports came in and showed people willing to pay $50 or $100 over the premium, the paper market should have reversed and went up to match it, but it didn't. Physical demand eventually will be the straw that breaks the camel's back to the paper market when it becomes so overwhelming. And another important thing that's happening is we're seeing a great shift to where the paper market is trading. We're seeing more and more trading in China. We now know the Koreans have announced they're going to open a gold exchange. And we're seeing it move away from the Western world and the COMEX, or what I like to call the CRIMEX. And I think the handwriting is on the wall to those parties there. That's why I believe certain real big guys have already moved away, and they see the handwriting on the wall. It may be a little bit longer before it shifts dramatically, but they're getting ahead of the crowd. So I think physical demand is key because eventually it breaks the back of the paper manipulators.
You know, the Fed, the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England are expected to continue with their record stimulus activities. Currency devaluation and this race to the bottom is picking up some momentum, according to some folks. The dollar, you know, it keeps recoiling from these attempts to break out on the upside. The greenback has been in this bottoming pattern, I bet you've noticed as well, over the last three consecutive years. Now, when the housing market did the same thing last year, it actually broke out from a three-year bottom to new highs. Will the greenback follow the housing market's lead, or is this really just a pause for much lower prices in the U.S. dollar?
Well, I don't think it's going to follow it, and the reason I feel that way is I think we're going to see a surprise in the Europe gaining momentum. We're starting to see some early signs. We had one today of Europe coming out of its economic doldrum. Certainly not any rockets going off yet, but certainly some early indication one can see when there's an economic rebound. And if there's even the slightest economic rebound in Europe, which has been totally discounted now for years, I think that will knock the socks off of the U.S. dollar. So my opinion is the next surprise in that market is the euro rallying on the heels of better economic numbers over the coming months, and that will help weaken the U.S. dollar. So I don't see the U.S. dollar following the housing market. And I just want to make one quick comment since you brought up the housing market. I don't think the housing market is roaring. I just think it was so decimated that what's happening now in 10 or 15 years ago would have considered been a real bad housing market, but it was so atrociously bad it looks like it's rebounded a lot. But I don't think that's the case, and one of the things we'll see is when the economy starts to roll over again, in my opinion, this fall and winter, we're going to see the housing market start to roll over as well, And we're just starting to see that in some numbers, especially the late numbers of permits and early initials sales are actually starting to be weaker than people expected. And I think we've had the so-called technical bounce in that market, and I think the housing market will roll over next year. I would certainly be a person that would avoid housing stocks at this point in time after the dramatic run-up.
No, we were recommending the housing sector over the past year with spectacular gains, but I am on board with you. The metric that I follow most closely, a new housing starts. 3 months ago, we plunged. We had a little anemic bounce, and then we've come down again in the most recent number. That's broken the trend, the upward trend that persisted for 12 months. This is a very bearish sign and a red flag. And, of course, new housing starts, one of the better leading economic indicators. This is more than likely a dead cat bounce. Peter Grandich, could you please tell folks more about the Grandich newsletter so they can find out more about your commentary on the mining and metals markets?
Sure, Grandich.com. I work as a compensated consultant to mining companies, as well as I share 30 years' worth of insights on economics, general markets, commodities, and what have you. It's free of charge at Grandich.com.
Very good. Well, we always appreciate your insights and wisdom, and we'll look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio. It's that time to get caught up on a few listeners' questions and comments today, so opening up the mailbag. First at bat, it's Michael. He asks, what happens to mining stocks when the COMEX defaults? Well, hi, Michael. You know, if the COMEX enters default, as many folks have speculated, including Kyle Bass, not generally known in the gold crowd, at least, but he has made it very clear that on his trip to the COMEX, that there's only roughly 2 or 3% of the gold and silver necessary to meet all of those paper contracts outstanding. So he's speculated that a gold default is inevitable. Of course, there are other gold and silver exchanges, such as the London Exchange and now in China. However, the Shanghai Gold Exchange is much smaller, about one-tenth the size of the COMEX. Of course, that's going to change, I expect, very quickly. Nevertheless, the impact of a COMEX default could be quite profound. I would expect bullion and related equities to leap in price by as much as 20 to 50% overnight, following the announcement. That would be quite similar to what we saw occur to the gold shares on 9/11, the World Trade Center tragedy. Shares soared as short scrambled to cover, not knowing just how the news would impact demand for the yellow metal. You'd likely see eBay take over as a major precious metals distributor and exchange, as well as many of the large sellers such as Appmex.com, gold retailers. We've, in fact, I think, seen many of these retailers already create their own secondary markets, such as Gold Eagle, which allows for instantaneous trading around the clock in a futures-like setting. So to directly answer your question, unlike the 1970s where the COMEX was the go-to exchange, with so many alternatives today, I think the market would quickly absorb the sea change event. However, anyone holding precious metals before the announcement, I think, would certainly see a substantial gain. Thanks very much, Michael. Moving on to Klaus, he says that I used to have some nice dividend-paying REITs in my Alpha Stocks newsletter. Some investors consider REITs as an inverse proxy for interest rates. If we are entering a cycle of rising interest rates for the next decade, would this lead to lower share prices for these vehicles? Keep up your great work. Love the show. Hi, Klaus. You know, I think you're correct. The REIT sector was a primary focus of many of my Alpha Stocks picks over the past year. The return has been, of course, very excellent when you factor in the extraordinarily high dividend yields on average over 10%. But my outlook on the sector is not quite as robust as it was. You'll want to listen to my discussion with Harry S. Dent Jr. later in the show on real estate. We are both concerned that the rebound could be temporary in housing, which could significantly impact the prospects of REITs going forward. In addition, at this week's FOMC meeting statement, well, officials made it clear that rates will be held low until unemployment falls back to the 6.5%. Currently, the domestic unemployment rate is around 7.6%, so I don't expect the Fed to allow rates to climb much higher. Now, you might ask yourself, how can they do that? They could twist rates by selling long-term bonds and buying short-term treasuries, which, of course, puts up the price and puts down the yield. Okay, thanks, Klaus. Next up at the batter's box, Eric from Blythewood, South Carolina, says he's followed my advice for many years in preparation for the forthcoming events, including inflation and what that will do to the economy. Well, his question is about the possibility of a replacement of the physical dollar with a digital currency. He fears the process would be very easy for the government to implement, and the results would be very favorable to the government. Large amounts of previously unreported income would be collected by the IRS, and the barter economy would wither on the vine. Hypothetically speaking, what are your thoughts on this situation? Well, hi, Eric. You know, I think this is a very interesting question. It's one that keeps me up at night sometimes. We are already reading reports of nations doing their best to discourage gold and silver ownership. For instance, in Europe, some countries are limiting the amount of precious metals purchased or sold. In Houston, fingerprinting and photos of gold selling is mandatory. However, I am sure you saw what happened with Bitcoin. There was a temporary shutdown on the market, and although Bitcoin still sell over $100, which is very impressive, many questions remain regarding their viability as a future currency alternative. Again, now, I am a huge fan of the Bitcoin market because I think it is a phenomenal breakthrough, but here's a scenario to ponder. Where else can we crystallize our wealth in a highly concentrated form, bury it in the backyard near, let's say, a metal pipe line to protect against metal detection? One single roll of gold coins can cost $100,000 or more. Would you feel that confident if you had $100,000 in, let's say, a digital currency, or in a safety deposit box, or in a brokerage somewhere? While the powers that be will continue to attempt to discourage the hoi polloi from owning precious metals, they still remain, I think, the very best place to protect your family's wealth. Okay, thanks for that interesting question, Eric. And next up, Chris says, why are the radio show archives unavailable? Hi, Chris. We were recently required to remove the archives to comply with the wishes of some pretty powerful interests. We hope at some point to solve the problem and make the shows freely available again to the public. Thanks, Chris. And next up, they'd like a yearly subscription to the Alpha Stocks newsletter, but do not have a PayPal account. And they ask if there is any other option, such as money order or credit card. Hi, yes, many Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers prefer to send in personal checks or money orders. You can request my address via email, and I'll just send it to you. The Alpha Stocks portfolio is doing very well. The 10% dividend yield, plus several percentage point profit already under its belt. In addition, we have a new daily stock picks, which continue to excel. The key is the stock screening and then filtering process, which reduces many hundreds of candidates down to just one or two per day. We monitor the market sentiment to help investors gauge when price is overbought and oversold given the current market trend. Now that the gold and silver equities are forming a bottom, we will be updating the precious metals equities model portfolio, which incidentally continues to outperform the XAU by about 10% annually. And don't forget the moonshot stock picks. Our penny stocks range from a few cents to a few dollars, many of which have returned 250% or more. So if you'd like to sign up, you can do so at the website, or as I said a moment ago, you can just send in a check if you'd like. We have very reasonable monthly, annual, 5-year and lifetime subscription rates. Next, Paul says he loves the show, but is unable to listen to the July 12th radio show with Bob Hoy. Hi, Paul. Yes, as I mentioned just a moment ago, we have all of our archives down for the moment, so just the last 3 or so shows are available, but we'll certainly announce it if and when they can be made available again. And next, Andrew is having the same issue. He tried to download a show from the June 28th interview with Lindsay Williams, but it wouldn't work. He wants to know if we can fix it. Well, as I mentioned, Andrew, we're going to do our best to have that back up as soon as possible. Thanks again. And lastly, Larry says he enjoys the show. He finds it very informative and entertaining. He's been listening for many years and wants us to keep up the great effort. As for the Houston fingerprinting of gold sellers in that area, he says it's only for the sale of jewelry, not coins and bars. He says it's to make it harder for thieves to sell their stolen gold jewelry. He wants me to make a correction so as not to frighten folks. Well, hi, Larry. Actually, according to the Houston Daily Examiner, the Houston City Council voted to require fingerprinting and photographs of anyone selling gold or silver of any kind. So until I can find evidence to the contrary, I think we may have to agree to disagree on this point. The idea, as you said, is to discourage home robberies and burglaries and to search for quick and easy gold and silver items. However, I am concerned about the unintended consequences, as I'm sure you are as well. For instance, do we really want the government to know anything about gold transactions? Why not encourage homeowners to own a gun and bolt locks on each door? At one of my alma maters, KSU, the town ordinance insisted that every homeowner must have a gun on the premises. It's the law. The town still has one of the lowest burglary and crime rates in the nation. So you can form your own opinions there. I'm not a huge firearms advocate, but it certainly seems highly correlated with a safer home. With that question, unfortunately, we've run brief on time. We're going to have to wrap up this week's show. But remember, we want to field your questions and comments, and you can call in if you'd like to. Toll-free 1-800-507-6531. Make sure that this is toll-free in your area. It is in most of the U.S. and parts of Canada. But you want to make sure first. You can call in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Any question you might have, you can cancel, delete, and re-record if you like. 1-800-507-6531. Perhaps you'd prefer to remain anonymous. That's just fine. Or you might share your first name to give people an idea of who they're listening to. 1-800-507-6531. We hope you'll jot this down on a post-it pad or plug it right into your cell phone or telephone number. We'd like to field your questions and comments. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. So stay with us. So glad you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio for another Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Harry S. Dent Jr. Well, the FOMC released its latest meeting statement this week. Joining me to help decipher the Fed speak, Harry S. Dent Jr., head of an economic research and forecasting company and author of The Great Depression Ahead. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Oh, nice to be back, Chris.
You know, I'd like to begin the discussion, if we could, with the latest FOMC meeting statement. The Fed noted that the unemployment rate remains stubbornly high, just echoing recent sentiments. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the national unemployment rate still around 7.6%. That's well above the Fed's 6.5% target following recent recessions. Unemployment typically would fall back in line with traditional measures. Not so this time. You know, Walmart is now our largest U.S. employer. From your perspective, why is the Fed having such a difficult time with unemployment?
Well, you know, it comes down to demographics, as we always say. Every time we've had a recession in the 80s or 90s, or baby boomers were always going to spend more money. They were in a positive spending cycle demographically, and the economy would come bouncing back. Well, it's not. I mean, the only reason the economy is growing at 2%, which has been the average since 2009 from the bottom, has been because of massive stimulus to help plug the holes and to help get people to spend just a little more. It's taken $2 trillion a year to get 2% growth or $300 billion in GDP. That's a horrible ratio and a horrible, horrible trade-off. So they're fighting demographic winds. They're fighting debt levels that were higher than any time in history compared to GDP in the business sectors and the financial sectors and the consumer sectors. And, you know, that's a drain on the economy. So
Everybody's assuming, oh, the Fed just needs to stimulate till the economy gets back to normal. The economy's not going to get back to normal for another decade until the next generation comes along. And somewhere between now and then, I think sooner than later, we're going to have to deal with our debt and allow debt to deleverage like it did in the 1930s. You can't go forward. Japan's been trying to move forward with rising debt instead of falling, and they've just been in an economy for 23 years now, and it's taking even more massive stimulus there just to get them to grow a little bit. And so, you know, people don't realize the economy's not going to get back to normal. Demographic trends point down for the next decade, and debt levels are actually higher than they were when the crisis started in 2008 because government debt has gone up more than private debt's gone down. You can't keep adding debt to debt when one of the reasons you got in the first place was we had too much debt. And everybody's acting like the Fed can just, you know, get the economy to grow again. Well, they are getting it to grow a little, but with massive stimulus.
Look at the macro picture. Most of these economic models that our officials are following are generally cyclical in nature, and they tend to trough out and then peak out, and then you're back to business as usual. But I think what you're really suggesting here is a profound sea change event where things don't go back to normal, an economic reset where this debt must be finally dealt with. It can't just be shuffled off or pushed under the table. Ultimately, the day of reckoning is here.
Japan actually has been avoid dealing with it now for 23 years. But Japan went into its crisis when the rest of the world was booming. And we were about the only people to see that in the late 80s. We said Japan's going to have a 12 to 14-year demographic downturn, and the U.S. and Europe are going to see their best decade ever because the demographics of the baby boom in those countries are different. But in the case here, now it's the Fed, every other major government in the world, desperately stimulating all at the same time. Europe keeps weakening. China's bubble looks more and more like it's going to blow at some point. The Fed and other governments are stimulating at very high rates, and the economy at least creeps forward, with the exception of Europe, when you do that. The problem is if something goes wrong. And in 2008, that was the subprime crisis in the U.S. And you got to realize that was really occurred largely in just four or five states. Yet we had a worldwide crisis because all these banks are interlinked and everybody's stretched with debt already and demographics were starting to slow. So that's what I'm looking for. I mean, we've been bouncing now for over 4 years. Very few rallies last more than 3.5 to 5 years. I think something's going to go wrong. Europe gets worse. Somebody in the Eurozone has to exit or get kicked out. China's real estate bubble finally starts to burst because they're having to rein in on it because they have a shadow banking system now that's growing faster than any in the world, and China's being forced to deal with it. Well, you deal with that, and then real estate prices go down. Real estate prices go down. Everybody in China owns real estate. And they save way more than we do, and they put most of their money in real estate, especially since the stock crash, you know, in 2008. And if real estate starts going down, Chinese consumers are going to feel it heavily. And if China slows down the whole world, that's the last thing holding the world up with the minor growth in the U.S. And actual recession more in Europe. So it's just going to take a trigger, and my guess is that's going to happen between late 2013 and early 2014. Markets are looking bubbly, but they're not looking like they're going to top yet. I mean, I think we're going to see Dow 16,000 here fairly soon, and I don't think that's going to be a top. But I do think you're going to start to see some sort of crash by early next year.
Yeah, Bill Fleckenstein is on board with you there. He's looking for a sudden drop to the downside, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I'd like to return, though, to the recent Fed statement this week. Their mandate of maximum employment and low inflation, apparently they're going to continue with their QE policies in order to keep improving employment, continue purchasing additional mortgage-backed securities at a pace of $40 billion a month, plus their treasuries at $45 billion a month. That amounts to about $1 trillion a year. Now, you know, the Fed's balance sheet is currently $3.3 to $3.4 trillion. Do you see that trend continuing?
Well, you know, if we're we're allowed to. If we don't have a crisis that triggers a meltdown, that the Fed and central banks lose control of it, we just do the same thing Japan's been doing for many, many years. In a decade, we're going to have a $30 trillion government debt, and we're going to have a Fed balance sheet of $12 to $15 trillion. I mean, if this was a temporary crisis, then it could make sense to have QE to just kind of jumpstart the economy. But we've been doing QE nonstop now for 4.5 years. And by my calculations, looking at the demographic trends, and with us not dealing with debt, and debt's only going up, not down, you'd have to keep doing this for another 10 years. Well, we'll just roll out the numbers. I mean, $30 trillion is about where you're going to end up, and we'd have about the same debt-to-GDP ratio that Japan has, which is 250%. It'd be a little less than that for us. To think you can add debt to debt to cure a debt crisis, and to think that after 4 to 5 years, it's going to be a lot different. Governments have had to basically up the ante. China's upping the ante and pushing people off of farms and shoving them into high rises, even though they don't always have jobs. And, you know, Japan just tripled their stimulus out of desperation. And then, you know, the Fed upped the ante with QE3 and QE3 extended. And the truth is they're probably going to have to stimulate even more than this because the demographic trends only get worse. And the big thing for me, Chris, is the demographic trends in the next few years particularly get much worse in Europe, and Europe's already in trouble. So if Europe's in this much trouble and they haven't really fallen off what I call the demographic cliff yet, they've just kind of been on a plateau. If demographic trends start working more steadily against them, and guess which countries slow down first? Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and the UK, some of the strongest countries over there. So governments are going to have to stimulate as much or more for 10 years, and that's just not sustainable. At some point, bond markets and investors or somebody will pull the plug and say, okay, this isn't doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Well, we keep getting 2% growth in the U.S. no matter how much we stimulate. We keep getting negative growth, minor negative growth, instead of a depression. We get a minor recession in Europe despite all the bailouts and stimulus. And China keeps stimulating and making massive investments in their economy, you know, excess capacity. And their stock market keeps going down, and their GDP and exports keep slowing. So we're doing the same thing over and over again. And at some point, people are going to get, this ain't happening. This isn't working. And when people lose faith in it, then you're in trouble, just like when they lost faith in the southern European countries and interest rates started rising. If Mario Draghi hadn't stepped in and said, I'll basically blow you out of the water if you ever short a southern European bond, those countries would have been belly up. They would have had to gone bankrupt.
Housing sales recovered over the past year or so. We've seen pretty strong activity in that sector. Mortgage rates, though, are climbing, as noted in the latest FOMC meeting. They're watching that closely. Housing starts are, though, also sluggish. As a key component of the U.S. economy, what's your outlook on this sector?
Well, you know, housing is the most important sector. It was the last to turn around. People were the most in shock. They've never seen real estate go down in their lifetime in most places, because the last time was the 1930s. But now it's coming back. Interest rates got so low, and you know, you get backlog and demand. But the biggest thing that happened that most people don't realize is that, you know, the Fed keeps pumping all this money into Wall Street and the financial systems, and it has to be invested somewhere. Well, it's gone into stocks. Well, they bubbled up. It's gone into gold and commodities. Well, they bubbled up, and now they're falling. So a lot of hedge funds and investment funds say, well, we're going to start buying foreclosed houses and flipping them or renting them out. So a lot of this rebound in housing, they don't have the normal levels of buying from young couples who are really getting a mortgage and buying a house they're going to live in and have kids in. A lot of this is speculation, and there's signs that speculators are already retreating from this market because it's getting too pricey, it's getting too competitive. And if they drop out, I think housing with rising mortgage rates and investors starting to sour on it, I think in the next few months you could see housing start to slow down, and if not then, by early next year. And I think that could be a pivot point because, yeah, jobs have been pretty good, but not if housing slows down again. So I think housing is the key sector, and I don't think the housing rebound lasts past this year. That's my forecast.
As rates go up, it simply just prices people out of the market. Folks start to say, well, maybe renting not such a bad option after all. I mean, who can afford these increases in monthly payments? And as you mentioned, you know, we've watched hedge funds and many other investment companies buying up the lion's share of these homes recently. And what happens is people just start renting them out. So renting is the new home ownership. At least that it seems to be the case. You know, we're seeing a huge drop across the nation here and many other frightening metrics. For instance, one recent survey showed that 4 out of 5 Americans are struggling with unemployment at some point in their career. And there simply hasn't been a time like this in national history, at least not if in many decades. Do you care to give folks an idea on whether or not this is going to become the new norm? Is this what we should expect? Or is this merely some turbulence on the way to prosperity?
It's not just a new norm. For the average household, it's been the norm even in the boom. Ever since about 2000, median household income, real, you know, adjusted for inflation, has been falling, and it continues to fall. The rich have been getting most of the gains, the upper 20%, who are 3.5% unemployment, college graduates, and they control over 50% of spending. You got the top 10%, even better than the top 1%. They're getting all the gains. A couple surveys now that reflect just what you said. 80% of people say we never came out of the Great Recession. 20% say, no, I'm doing better than ever. That's the difference. We got two economies. And the biggest difference is the top 20% spend a lot more money, so they control a little over 50%. So you got half of our economy doing great and half of it just struggling to get along. That struggling to get along is not going to change. It hasn't changed. It'll only get worse. The real question is, when do the rich see their kids leave the nest like the everyday person did in 2008 forward? And I think that's going to happen in the next year or two, because their kids just graduate later and they go to school later. So they peak in their spending later. But also, any turbulence in the markets, if real estate starts to collapse again, and especially stocks and financial assets, these top 20% hold almost all those financial assets, and they're going to feel it more. I think the affluent people are the next to go down, and when they go down, they're actually going to get hit worse relatively than the average household. But the average household's been struggling for you know, a decade and a half now.
I think one of the points of confusion here is clearly the way that we're looking at the numbers. For instance, everybody's looking at unemployment with regard to recessions and economic growth. But in the final analysis, economists firstly look at the GDP. Now, how is the GDP calculated? Well, using an inflation deflator. And if you aren't using accurate inflation numbers, your GDP number is completely off, because if you look at shadow stats, and we calculate our own GDP here, you're exactly right when you say things have been tough since the year 2000. There has been essentially no forward movement, forward progress, in about 14 years as far as economic growth goes when you accurately calculate the price number or the inflation number. About 76% of Americans report that they are living from paycheck to paycheck. This is an unimaginable number, and we're talking in the neighborhood of, let's say, 240 million people, or the majority of households, are simply struggling to make ends meet. A big factor here is the unemployment situation, but the other component is prices, rising inflation. I'd like your thoughts on that, please.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the basic stuff, food and gasoline and stuff, you know, that people spend on day-to-day are going up. Yeah, housing's going down, but a lot of these people are already stuck in their house and can't get out of it. They want to, can't even refi because they don't qualify with a home underwater. So, yeah, they're not getting the benefits. The more affluent are getting the benefits of rising markets and their home prices and all this sort of stuff. But the average person can't even refinance their house, you know, now that this has happened. So yeah, I mean, the middle class, there used to be 20% of our economy, maybe, or 30% struggling, living paycheck to paycheck. Now the middle class is living paycheck to paycheck. And yes, that hasn't happened since the middle class really emerged after World War II. Okay. That didn't happen in the 1970s when you really get down to it, even that recession.
Okay, so let's investigate then just why this is happening. And I think, you know, my pet thesis here is that there simply aren't substantial jobs being created. And why is that? Because I think our officials and legislators have dropped the ball with regard to the significance of the self-employed and the entrepreneur. Our largest employer right now, Kelly Services and Walmart. This, I think, is indicative of a society that has forgotten what made it great in the first place. So instead of taxing the very few people who are still self-employed. It's the lowest level in national history, into oblivion. You know, perhaps the government needs to be considering tax breaks and incentives to get that entrepreneurial spirit back into gear. I'd like your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to find a way to create new businesses and better jobs. And it really is more the entrepreneurs than the local dry cleaners, because they're kind of be around one way or the other. But it is true. I mean, we lost a lot of jobs. And we don't look at the unemployment rate. We look at the total workforce and how many jobs we actually lost and how many we're gaining them back and how many much we should have had if we had grown normally. And there's still a big gap. But the big thing is your kind of like pointing out is that we lost good jobs and they've gotten replaced by part-time jobs or lower-paying jobs. That's not good. And then again, that creates the people who are getting hired back are living paycheck to paycheck and struggling because maybe they. I mean, I was just talking to a guy. You know, he said I used to make $25 an hour. Now I make $17 on average. I mean, that's that median household going down, and that's not even adjusted for inflation. I mean he's down even in nominal dollars substantially, so that's a real problem.
The typical household now is earning substantially less than $30,000 a year, with most homes now either at or near the poverty level. In addition, one out of every four American workers has a job that pays just $10 an hour or less. That's 25% of the employed. We're at one of the lowest levels of total employment in national history. And then also add to the fact that we're near one of the lowest levels of full-time employment, which is another factor we really haven't even touched on here, ties in with the low quality salaries, incomes, and benefits for workers. But, you know, I'd like to shift gears away from this for a moment, and I'd like your thoughts on now that the rate hike is out of the bag and we've passed that, we realize rates had to move up a bit. We've seen that adjustment, and we've certainly seen a very big price reaction in gold and silver. Do you see better times ahead?
I do for a while. Gold broke some really important. I mean, it was trading sideways between 1,525 and 1,800 for almost 2 years, and then broke out of that channel, out of a pattern of a sharp increase before that. That I tell you, 9 out of 10 times should have gone to new highs, and it didn't. So I think what happened to gold was that Indians, who are the biggest buyers in the world up until recently, their rupee started falling for all types of reasons, and the price of gold for them went up, and then they cut back their buying. And then the second thing that happened in early 2013, after QE3 extended, and then the Japanese super aggressive, unprecedented QE announcement, gold went down, and the reason was inflation was falling from 2% to 1%. You're right, they don't measure it right, but that's what the street sees and everybody. And I think gold just finally got an argument I've been making a long time that we're not going to see in substantial inflation or hyperinflation out of all this money printing, because it's just going into financial bubbles. It's going into speculation. It's not going into the economy. It's not creating jobs. It's not creating businesses, you know, and all that sort of stuff. It's not being lent and spent. Money velocity is still dropping like a rock. So gold took this big drop. Probably for several months, gold's going to rally. My target would be about $1,500 to $1,525 on gold. And if it gets up there, if gold can get back above 1525 and stay there for a while, then it's got a shot at making a new high. But we are due for a substantial bounce for a good while. And that's just hedge funds selling on leverage. When something like that goes down, it's way beyond the fundamentals, just like oil collapsing and, you know, $147 to $32 in 4 months in 2008. That is leveraged hedge funds and traders dumping for margin calls. That's not fundamental speaking as so much.
Also, we're seeing some interesting developments in the futures contracts. We see the backward dating in the 2014 contract on silver and gold. And I can't really think of a time where we saw backwardation in both silver and gold concurrently. We saw it in silver for almost two consecutive years, but never did we see it also in gold and silver. Plus, the COT report indicates that the institutions are covering their shorts almost back to neutral, their short positions, and the specs, of course, are no longer heavily long, and this tends to lead to tradable bottoms. Why don't you tell folks more about your latest, as well as all the services that you provide at your website?
Yeah, our latest book is The Great Crash Ahead. Came out 2 years ago. I've got a new book coming out in January called The Demographic Cliff. But most important, I have a number of newsletters, but we now have a free daily newsletter called Survive and Prosper, and you can get that for free. Sign up just by going to www.harrydent.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, we're so glad you're back with us here at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's special guest, Jim Rogers, halfway around the globe at his home office in Singapore. It's a pleasure to welcome back Jim Rogers from his office in Singapore. Good morning, Jim Rogers.
I am delighted to be here. Lots has been going on.
Let's start off today with the equities market. You know, the Dow is near a record all-time high. Earnings continue to be solid. The IPO market is red hot lately. However, insider selling is high. Where do you stand on equities?
You point out, the U.S. market is making all-time highs. I don't particularly like buying anything when it's making all-time highs, although with the rate of money printing in the U.S., it could conceivably go higher or even turn into a bubble. There are signs that it might. Mr. Bernanke and his cohorts have said they will continue to print staggering amounts of money. And while it's artificial, you know, artificial doesn't matter because lots of money flooding into the world markets has got to go somewhere. And one of the places it's going is U.S. stocks. I'm not buying at the moment, but I'm watching closely. I doubt if I get the timing right. Somewhere along the line, this is going to end very badly for all of us. Because, you know, it's not just the U.S. central bank that's doing it. It's for the first time in recorded history, we have all the major central banks printing money at the same time. Japan, Europe, U.K. It's always ended badly when a nation does this in the past. This is the first time we've had everybody doing it. So I, for one, am very worried about how it's going to end.
Recently, Dr. Ben Bernanke backpedaled, though, regarding his QE tapering thesis. You say that central banks, they eventually have to stop printing, but can the Fed and their comrades really afford to lose control of their sovereign treasury markets? And won't they just use QE methods to hold rates in check until unemployment gets back to traditional levels?
That's their plan, yes. And so far, so good. Obviously, they would say to you that they've done a brilliant job. I, of course, would say they're doing a disastrous job, but they would say, no, not that. But what will happen in the end, one of two things has to happen, because this cannot go on forever. They either decide on their own that this has to stop, and they stop or they slow down, or you said they cannot lose control. Well, they don't want to lose control. But whether they like it or not, or whether we like it or not, at some point, the market will say, hey, this is no good. We don't want to play this game anymore, and we won't take your garbage paper. If and when that happens, of course, we all have terrible, terrible problems in the world, because then the central banks lose control, things go escape there, what they would like to happen, and that's going to be pure chaos, not just in the financial markets, but in the currency markets and all markets and in the world. So it's got to end. It can't go on forever because, if nothing else, the world will run out of trees eventually. So it's going to end whether they try to control it or the market forces them to end it. And either way, it's not going to be fun for the rest of us.
You know, I think that's an interesting segue into another point you've made recently. You went on record that the first two U.S. central banks will close their doors, and eventually the Fed will close its doors. Do you care to predict roughly when, how it will affect the domestic and global economies, as well as what type of system might take its place?
Well, yes, we've had three central banks in U.S. history. The first two disappeared. for whatever reason. And in my view, this one will disappear too, because Dr. Bernanke and Dr. Greenspan just have no clue about how the world works. And they have run up huge amounts of debt onto the central bank balance sheet. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, the U.S. central bank had $800 billion on its balance sheet, and it was mainly government bonds. Now, more than quadrupled the assets on its balance sheet. Some of those assets are garbage. You know, they bought up a lot of garbage, in their view, doing the right thing. They might be doing the wrong thing, but it doesn't matter. The facts are they now have four times the balance sheet that they had 5 or 6 years ago, and this has badly because, I mean, that's not the way central banking is supposed to work, not traditionally and historically. It would have been inconceivable to any central banker in the world just a few years ago. But Dr. Bernanke claims he knows what he's doing. I claim he doesn't. The world without central banks has periodically had problems for a variety of reasons. But in my view, this central bank will fail one way or the other, whether Congress will say we've got to get rid of it because the problems will be so bad, or the public will demand getting rid of it because there will be so much inflation, so much debt, so much everything, which will be out of control, and so this central bank will fail. Now, as I said, a world without central banks has problems, but a world with these central banks, who printed staggering amounts of money worldwide and run up huge debt worldwide, will be better off without them, even though we might have other problems without them.
In an interview with Max Keiser this month, you noted that gold is making a significant bottom as leveraged players are forced to liquidate their big positions. And once this finally takes hold, although it could take months or even a couple of years, the bull market will eventually resume, resulting with new high prices. Is that a pretty fair assessment?
Well, that's a fair assessment in my view of the world, yes. I'm not sure we've seen the final bottom yet, although I hasten to tell you I'm terrible at market timing. In my view, we're making a complicated bottom. The problem, the situation with gold is, gold went up 12 years in a row, which is extremely unusual. I know of no market in history that's done that. So the anomaly with gold has been how strong it was for so long. So I would suspect that there will be an anomaly in its making its bottom. It will not just have a correction and then resume its market, as most things do, in my view, and I have no idea how it's going to work. I suspect that the anomaly in its correction will be strange, complicated, if nothing else. Eventually, we will make a new low, whether it's this year or next year or the year after, and then, of course, the bull market will resume, and we're off to the races, and wonderful new highs will be made, but it may be a few years from now.
You know, silver or poor man's gold could shine brightly as this bull market resumes. China and Japan have big plans for photovoltaic systems. The typical solar panel includes up to 1 ounce of silver, which is not easily reclaimed. One media source claims that Asian solar panel demand alone could be enough to absorb much of the new silver production in coming years. Do you have any thoughts on silver?
Same things you do, and also perhaps great medical advances of using silver. Emperors in Korea and other places, for instance, use silver as a protection against the poison and against the cures. And so we may find that silver has lots of uses for health, for other things we haven't thought of. Yes, I own silver. I'm not selling silver. It's rare that silver has a major divergence from gold. If gold goes down 50%, it's unlikely that silver will go up 50%, just to give an example. Yes, there's no question that silver may have a wonderful, wonderful future. I haven't sold any silver. I own silver. It's certainly down more than gold. If you look at a historic basis, only on a historic basis, I'm certainly not selling my silver, nor am I selling my gold. And if it corrects, and it has a wonderful correction, then I hope I'm smart enough to buy more silver and more gold.
No, anecdotally, that's a very interesting point. For the emperors of Korea actually did use 100% silver chopsticks in order to test for arsenic in their food, because arsenic poisoning due to sibling rivalry over the monarchy was so prevalent. Your investing approach is clearly very contrarian. You suggest that investors should search out sectors with the most bearish players to find value.
Well, I have no idea. My search for value leads to things like agriculture, things like Russia, things like airlines. I think there are things out there where one might find new and interesting investments. Perhaps some currencies. That's where I'm looking. One should also know how to sell short, given the, in my view, the turmoil which is coming to all of us in the next few years, whether it's in currencies or bonds or anything, shares. One certainly needs to know how to sell short. And even if one just puts their money in cash, I mean, that could be a disaster if the people who put their cash in Iceland found out, or some other countries, you know. Cash can ruin you if you have the wrong cash, even though you think that you're very safe and secure and conservative. So just be very careful. Conventional investing is not going to work in the next few years.
You always seem to be way ahead of the trends in all these interviews over the last 8 years on GoldSeek.com. So I'd like to ask you, what's on your radar screen that you think investors should start paying attention to in the coming months and years ahead?
Well, currency turmoil, interest rate turmoil, financial markets turmoil, including bankruptcies, the various and sundry things which are going to ruin us all, ruin a lot of people coming in the future. Just, it's not going to be like it's been in the past 10, 20, 30 years. It's going to be very different. I hope that I'm smart enough to figure it all out.
Jim Rogers, we want to thank you so much for taking time for us today and wish you continued success.
Well, thank you. I hope we all have continued success, but it's going to be difficult. We've all got to be careful. Let's do it again sometime.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I just returned home from a business trip with one of North America's veteran geological experts. We had an opportunity to share several meals together while traveling and have some pretty in-depth discussions about precious metals, the future of the mining industry, and one topic that can no longer remain hidden or masked: inflation. We stopped at a very popular fast food franchise, one I frequent myself but haven't eaten at with someone in quite some time. When I dine alone at this establishment, I don't pay as close attention to the pricing as I should. I know prices have gone up, but did not realize until tonight just how much of a beast inflation is becoming at breakneck speed. I ordered a large hamburger and a large soda. My business associate ordered two fish sandwiches, a large milkshake, and some fries. The bill was $19.60. We were both shocked. That's essentially a $20 bill for two people at a fast food joint. I questioned the girl behind the counter, and she confirmed the prices were correct, and then went on to tell us that prices had recently gone up, and she thought they were now the most expensive fast food restaurant of that kind. When this kind of sudden price inflation becomes instantly apparent, it etches itself into your conscious mind as if with a branding iron. And in that moment, you realize that despite all the talk about low inflation and managing expectations, the reality is that inflation is explosive and can no longer be contained. That something is definitely wrong and definitely out of your control. It produces a sudden burst of anxiety. In the conversation that followed, we discussed all the prices that have gone up and continue to go up. Not just fast food, but interest rates, groceries, electric, insurance, batteries, shampoo, haircuts, you name it, it's on the way up. But then we corrected ourselves, because in reality, these prices are not really going up. The value of the dollar is going down noticeably. When food manufacturers make smaller packages and sell it for the same price, they are not masking the rising price of that food item. What they are masking, whether they realize it or not, is the declining value of the dollar. Every company, manufacturer, or service provider who has engaged in these kind of pricing games have been aiding and abetting in a grand conspiracy to help facilitate and prolong the illusion of a strong dollar and low inflation, when in fact the dollar is getting weaker and inflation is getting higher. The illusion dominates, especially in housing. Many people I have talked to recently believe housing prices are going to continue to rise. Some even think they are going to reach their old highs from 2005 to 2007. And those old highs are going to represent the new floor in the market. I kid you not, I had that discussion with a builder this week. Just answer one question. Do you think wages will rise in accordance with those projected home prices? I don't. Which means as interest rates rise and people's wages do not rise, that the ability for people to afford higher priced homes will come to a screeching halt. The ability for people to afford many things is already coming to a screeching halt. The delayed effects of quantitative easing are beginning to surface throughout the economy. When fast food for two is $20, there's no denying a flash flood of inflation is upon us. Are you ready to move to higher ground? As in, right now? And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.